Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Weekly Digital Edition. My name is Daniel Williams. Today is Friday, November 7th, 2025, and I'll be reading from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly Edition, followed by articles from the news section in the region of the Middle East. We'll begin this week with an article. It comes from our Books for Global Readers section. The title is Cookbooks to Inspire, Invite, and Nourish Connections. Recipes and rituals are in abundance in these four sumptuous new titles. This article was written by Kendra Norden-Bido, a staff writer. And we do have several images on the page, so let's start with those. At the top of the page on the left-hand side, we have a dust jacket, the front of the book, and it's a book called Good Things, written by Samin Nosrat. And there is a subtitle called Recipes and Rituals to Share with People You Love. And it also says on the book jacket cover, author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. This book, again, was written by Samin Nosrat, and it was published by Random House, and it's 464 pages. The cover, just to give you a little idea of it, it is a basic white cover. There's nothing else on it there except for those words. So you have good things and the author's name. And interestingly enough, they're in bold lettering, bold font, but it's colorful. What pops off the page is each letter is a different color, and it goes from red to yellow to orange to purple. And then for the author's name, it starts in green, and it's shades of green, shades of blue, and then back to green. So that is the cover there. There is a photograph underneath there from Good Things. The photograph is we're looking down upon a table where people are eating. There are two sets of hands. It cuts off where you can't see much more of the people except for their hands and the table where all the food is. And so they each have a plate in front of them, and it looks like they're eating some things with their hands. It appears to be seafood. I do see some shrimp and crab legs on the plate. Below that, we have our next book. This one is titled Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories of the Origin of American Cuisine. It's written by Jessica B. Harris, published by Clarkson Potter, and it's 272 pages. This book jacket has a deep green, almost a forest green color to the background. In the foreground, we see a ham, a fully full ham that's about to be sliced up for a big feast. And then there's also some breaded vegetables and other food there on the plate beside it. In between the ham and the fruit and vegetables, we have a goblet. It's a green goblet that appears to have wine or some other drink in it. And then there's a solitary candle that's kind of shining light on the food there in this. And then we go to another plate of food below that. So it's the photograph is taken as if on top of the table. So it's looking down onto the table. That's how we're seeing these plates. And it appears to be desserts of some type. They are cookies and also a red, appears to be a red dessert. It's a small, like, biscuit-sized dessert here. It's looking down upon it, and it's been sliced open. So it's not easy to see what we're actually looking at there. And let's go ahead and start reading the article. Wait, there's one more photograph here. So in this photograph, it says that this photograph is also from the book Good Things. We are in a courtyard, and it appears to be a family or good friends, and they're all gathered around a table in this garden area, and they're smiling. They all have dark hair. Some of them have dark curly hair, and then some of them have dark hair, but it's closely cropped. And they are sitting around a table that has a white tablecloth on that table, and then there's food on it. The photograph is taken from pretty far away, so you can't see what the foods are that they're eating here. But in the background, you see three small children. One of them is chasing a yellow balloon that's tethered to a string, and the other two kids are sort of placing their hands up in the air, watching their family or family member or friend chasing the yellow balloon. So now let's read the article. Gathering with family, friends, and even strangers for a meal provides a space to listen and learn. Often those exchanges can be more nourishing than an appetizing spread, displacing feelings of isolation and discord. In this roundup of recent cookbooks, authors share how their personal creative processes in the kitchen, whether that's keeping things simple, contemplating the history of a recipe, or being inspired by the beauty of one's surroundings, can have a harmonizing, restorative effect. Samin Nosrat made her first splash in the cookbook world with the best-selling Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking in 2017. This fall, she returns with Good Things, Recipes, and Rituals to Share with People You Love. Similar to her first cookbook, the author supplies a bounty of foundational tips, such as how to choose and store the best ingredients and how to work efficiently with kitchen tools. But more importantly, Good Things offers recipes to support the communal experience of dinner time. Nosrat emphasizes that the effort spent on a dish shouldn't take precedence over spending time with those who have gathered to eat. The fuss and mess aren't worth it. It's a lesson she learned when cooking a birthday party meal for her friend's young son. After biting into a delicious taco, he said the only thing missing from his party was Nosrat, who was busy in the kitchen frying up perfect fish. "I've been trying to put what I learned from Orion that day into practice," Nosrat writes. "I spend less energy trying to do everything for everyone. Instead, I rely on a handful of recipes I think of as small, welcoming gestures and focus on spending quality time outside the kitchen with the people I love." Good Things is a meditation on those gestures that feed the soul as much as it is a cookbook for readers wanting to create a solid dinner ritual with friends and family. Our next book is Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine. It's the latest book from culinary historian Jessica B. Harris. Harris's previous work, High on the Hog, A Culinary History from Africa to America, from 2011, inspired the acclaimed four-episode docuseries on Netflix in 2020. In Braided Heritage, the historian takes an expansive look at early American cooking. She traces three foodways in sections titled Native Peoples, Europeans, and African Americans to show how these civilizations mixed and melded their culinary traditions to create what she calls the American braid. Our American food, perhaps more than any other aspect of our contentious conjoined cultures, shows us who we are at heart, writes Harris. This American cookbook is not a work of history, but rather an attempt to remind us of just how magnificently mixed we are on the plate, and have been from the very beginning of our national story. Harris admits that reducing the American braid to just three cultures leading up to the nation's founding in 1776 is an oversimplification. But given the vastness of the geographical United States and the breadth of time in which people have cooked and consumed food here, the generality is a reader service. Harris introduces each section with profiles of cultural practitioners of different parts of the braid, who describe how culinary traditions were passed down through their family. The recipe ingredients include clues to their origins. Native peoples hunted and gathered local ingredients such as mollusk, cranberries, and venison. Europeans brought pig, sheep, and apples, as well as shortbread, waffles, and donuts. African Americans carried with them agricultural and cooking techniques as their cultures were subjected to enslavement, immigration, innovation, and regionalism. The historical framework Harris provides for so many familiar American recipes illustrates how they shifted and changed as they were disseminated across the nation in its early centuries. It's hard to imagine what the prolific French cooking author has left to share with readers, but in our next book we'll look at The Art of Jacques Pepin, The Cookbook. It offers a retrospective on his time spent not only in front of the stove, but also at the easel. The Art of Jacques Pepin, through nearly 100 of his all-time favorite recipes, paired with his favorite artworks, covers all the bases for a meal: soups, pastas, fish, poultry, meat, and dessert. Cooking can be both solitary and communal, and like painting, the results are shared with many others. "When I cook, I always think about the people who will eat what I cook," writes Pepin. "I don't know whether my painting has helped me my cooking or whether my cooking has benefited my painting. All I know is that they live in harmony." While Pepin admits his paintings and drawings are the work of a dedicated amateur, his mastery and intuitive cooking shine through his recipes. His colorful art, a mix of impressionism and still lifes and vibrant hues, is a visual treat throughout. There are, of course, classic French recipes such as bread and onion soup, pork roast with ratatouille, as well as flan and creme à chocolat. Some recipes are as simple as a list of familiar ingredients with uncluttered instructions. For instance, the dessert section emphasizes clever ways to dress up fresh fruit in minutes. Settle it atop slices of pound cake or English muffins and top with a drizzle of jam or a dollop of cream. Pepin, the author of more than 30 cookbooks, reminds readers that in time the kitchen can be an art and a muse for creative expression. For our fourth book we'll look at, it's Coastal, 130 Recipes from a California Road Trip. Scott Clark takes readers along the storied California Central Coast to meet the region's organic farmers, regenerative ranchers, sustainable foragers, hunters, and fishers. This is the first cookbook for Clark, an East Coaster who found his home and calling making lunch in a rented caboose along California's Route 1 in Half Moon Bay. The author combines the techniques he learned from working in fine restaurants with the Central Coast's freshest ingredients. The result is a collection of recipes for elevated yet casual meals. "I thought I wanted Michelin glory. It turned out what I wanted was a life," writes Clark, who dropped out of high-pressure kitchens to spend more time with his family. "The Central Coast gave me that. Its abundance, its beauty, its precariousness, its chill. Surfing, sailing, ocean kayaking, gathering your salad ingredients from the tide pools and the woods. Clark's recipes are the kind you want after a day of adventuring. Among the appealing items served at the popular Dad's Luncheonette Diner are his hamburger sandwich, the heart and soul of Dad's. It zings with pickled onions and mustardy sauce, cheese, and one fried egg. Pair it with potato chips fried by the handful in a Dutch oven pot, and finish it with a sprinkling of kosher salt and nutritional yeast. His creativity shines in a recipe for Earl Grey Icebox Pie, a custard infused with tea on a graham cracker crust. Illustrated with many colorful photos from the Central Coast, Coastal is a delightful read for armchair travelers and a true love letter to Clark's chosen home. Now, we do have dust jacket photos here. So in the first one, it is the book The Art of Jacques Pepin the Cookbook, Favorite Recipes and Paintings from My Life in the Kitchen. It was written by Jacques Pepin, published by Harvest. It's 288 pages. The dust jacket is sort of a off-white color. It's just a very basic coloring here, sort of an off-white color. And the author's, the name of the book is in a dark blue. The subtitle, The Cookbook, is in a bright red. And then above that, you can see just the lower half of a plate of food. It burst with red coloring on this plate, spaced out along the rim of the plate is red. I believe it's tomatoes. It's difficult to say. It's either a tomato or a strawberry. And then at the center, so maybe it is a tomato, because at the center, it appears to be there's an artichoke. It is difficult to see that, though. Below that is one of the author's paintings, and it is in a sort of a primitive painted work here. It's a still life of different slices of fruit. They appear to be pears. Two of the pears still have their skin on. One of the pears has been sliced in two. And again, there is around the framing of the painting is little squiggly red lines. And then there's a sea of just sort of messy, almost greenish colors around the fruit. And then at the center of the image is that fruit there. Now our next book jacket, it's called Coastal, 130 Recipes from a California Road Trip. It's written by Scott Clark, published by Chronicle Books, and it's 288 pages. The word coastal is in red coloring, and it's a little bit almost like a hippie sort of font to it. It's sort of waving in the wind, so to speak, that word coastal. In the background, you see the ocean waves coming up. It's ocean foam. It appears to be at sunset. The coloring is beginning to go down. The lights are dimming on this coastal plain here. And then in the foreground, there is a high rocky cliff area, and there's a solitary person at the top of the cliff. It may be the author. You can't really make the person out very well, but there is a person at the top of the cliff. And then below that, there is, again, it's that overhead shot of the food, and it is several sandwiches placed together, kind of almost crammed together there on a singular plate. And there are leaves, appear to be spinach leaves, sticking out from the open sandwich. It's hard to make out what else is in there. It might be sliced up carrots and then perhaps a meat, maybe some beef or something along those lines. It looks like a darker meat there. And we have one more photograph, and this is from the book Coastal. And there is a gentleman wearing a baseball cap. He is sitting at a picnic table, and he's got a a spoon in a little cup of dessert, and it's a brown dessert. It's a custard or an ice cream. And he's got a scruffy face of a little bit of a beard. He's got a tattoo on his neck. And he's smiling at a young lady. She appears to be an Asian young lady. And she was wearing a blue baseball cap. Her eyes are closed. And she's got a big smile, smiling at the gentleman. She also has a spoon into this custard or ice cream dish. And in the background of the two people, you can see the ocean waves foaming up behind them. So let's go to our next article. And we remain in the book section for our next article. And let's get to the title. It's called Hostage, Tells a Harrowing Tale of Abduction and Survival. El Sharabi's memoir of captivity by Hamas is both difficult to read and difficult to put down. This article was written by Barbara Spindell, who's a contributor. We have a couple of images. In the center of the page, we have a gentleman who is wearing a black dinner jacket, a black blazer, and a sort of pinkish button-down shirt. He has a necklace around his neck, and there is writing on the necklace. It is very difficult to make that out. It's too small. There is a peace sign on his lapel, and the gentleman is about 1 or 2 days unshaven, so there's a little bit of scruff on his face. His hair is cut pretty short on top of his head, and he has a very, very serious look on his face. Beside that, there is the dust jacket. It says nonfiction, and then it says the book, Hostage. That's all it says in white print, Hostage, across the page. The dust jacket is completely black, so those letters are white. Then below that, in yellow lettering, is the author's name, Eli Sharabi. And it's below that it says, he is the author, that the publisher is Harper Influence, and that the book is 208 pages. So let's go to the article about this book. When a group of Hamas terrorists dragged Eli Sharabi from his home in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th, 2023, he yelled, "I'll come back!" in the direction of his wife and two daughters. After being held in Gaza for 491 days, he did come back. And now he has written the searing Hostage as a record of his ordeal. Readers know from the outset what Sharabi didn't learn until his release on February 8, 2025. His wife, Leanne, 16-year-old Noya, and 13-year-old Yahel were murdered in their home after Sharabi was abducted. The book's dedication page features a photo of their smiling faces alongside a photo of the author's brother, Yossi, who was killed in captivity. One wonders whether Sharabi would have endured had he known of these losses. As he tells it, from the moment he is driven from Israel into Gaza by the euphoric terrorist, he remains laser-focused on one thing, surviving and returning to his loved ones. Leanne was raised in England, and she and the girls had dual British-Israeli citizenship. The belief that Hamas might be reluctant to harm British citizens provides Sharabi a measure of reassurance over the next 16 months. Hostage is a frank account of Sharabi's time in captivity. It is both difficult to read and difficult to put down. The author, 51 when he was kidnapped, faces steadily deteriorating circumstances. Initially, he is hidden in a home with another hostage, a terrified Thai worker named Kun. Despite being shackled, the two men are relatively comfortable and well-fed. Because Sharabi speaks Arabic In addition to Hebrew and English, he slowly gets to know his two Hamas guards and the males of his household. He is relieved above all that he has not been taken down to Hamas's network of tunnels, whose reputation is of a bottomless underworld with no light, no air, and no return. On his 51st day in Gaza, Shirabi's situation changes. He is forced deep underground into the tunnels. He is so frightened of what awaits him that he considers resisting, knowing that doing so will lead to his death. "There is always a choice," he writes. The author is brought to a room that eventually holds six other Israeli hostages, all younger men who had been abducted from the Nova Music Festival. On their third morning together, a guard appears and tells three of them, Hirsch Goldberg-Pollen, Almog Sarusi, and Ori Danino, to gather their things. They are being released. Shirabi writes that he was deeply jealous but happy for them. Only much later does he learn that they were all executed in the tunnels. Shirabi remains with the other three, Olan Ohel, Or Levy, and Ilya Cohen. The tunnel has electricity and running water, and they receive two meals a day. They understand that the terrorists want to keep them alive because they are, in the author's words, Hamas's bargaining chips. After 40 days, however, Israeli airstrikes above ground force them to move to a different tunnel. Here, the rooms are smaller, and there is no power or water. As the war presses on above them, food and supplies become scarce. They are surrounded by raw sewage and ravaged by hunger, sometimes given only one stale piece of pita for the day. Colonies of worms begin to multiply around them and infest their meager belongings. Shirabi describes them as living in suffocating proximity to fear, longing, darkness, despair, bathed in that ubiquitous stench. When their captors are in a group, the author observes, they become meaner and humiliate us more, taunting them and forcing them to wait before being allowed to relieve themselves. As individuals, they occasionally offer small kindnesses, like giving the famished hostages a wedge of a clementine. But one day, a guard receives a phone call with bad news. He flies into a rage and attacks Shirabi, punching and kicking him. For a month, Shirabi is in intense pain, barely able to sit up. Through it all, Shirabi demonstrates an extraordinary resilience, which helps him cope with unimaginable anxiety and deprivation. Shirabi's professional background is in management, helping him mediate the conflicts that inevitably arise among hostages confined together for months in a cramped space, scared and starving. He fights their dehumanization, emphasizing that there are still some things that they can control. He insists that each night they name at least one good thing that happened that day. Perhaps a despised guard didn't enter their room, or a kinder guard gave them tea. It's wrenching to read about how Shirabi's love for his family keeps him going. Quote, "I've got to believe they're all right so I can hold on for them, so I can survive for them," he writes. But he understands that his wife and children might be dead, that he must prepare himself for that possibility and focus on surviving for his own sake, too. "I want to live," he recalls thinking. "I love life. I crave it. I want to breathe life, to walk free, to return to the open skies, to go back home, to work, to purpose." Countless people in the region have endured horrific suffering after more than 2 years of war. Still, it is gratifying that one good and hopeful man has had his life returned to him, as completely changed as it must be. Going to our next article now, we remain in the book section. This is titled, A Mystery Wrapped in Moss and Buried in a Bog. In this strangely beguiling novel, ambitious humans come and go, and only the earth abides. This book was written by Heller, the article is written by Heller McAlpin, a contributor. The book is Bog Queen by Anna North. It's published by Bloomsbury Publishing, and it's 288 pages. Now, we see the dust jacket in the center of the page. In this, we first see in a light green coloring in bold print the word Bog Queen, a novel. Below that in white print, we see the author's name, Anna North. And then below that in smaller white print, we see the words New York Times bestselling author of Outlawed. Then in the mid part of the dust jacket here, we see it looks like a jungle, and we're seeing it from the ground floor. And what we see are ferns and other greeny, mossy plants. And we see little bursts of flowers and plants. They're orange and yellow and red in color. And they're bursting. Some of them look like tiny umbrellas, and other ones look like the umbrellas before they're opened up. But then behind that, in the starkest white coloring, it begins to emerge what we see in profile, laying down in the bedding of the forest floor. We see a face, and it appears to be a body, and it is a stark white color of this human being who is in the background of this image. So let's go and read the article about this book now. You never know who's going to play a momentous role in your life. In Anna North's Bog Queen, two smart, ambitious women born two millennia apart, a Celtic druid and a forensic scientist, bring unexpected acclaim to one another. In recent years, brilliant female scientists have become the darlings of literature, an expedient way to write about accomplished, can-do women who deserve to be taken seriously. To cite just three examples of such characters, Elizabeth Zott, a research chemist fighting for recognition in a male-dominated world in Bonnie Garmus's Lessons in Chemistry, and then Lee Hassenbosch, a Dutch microbiologist who is sent into space on a secret mission in Martin McCannis's In Ascension. And then there's Ada Twist, an insatiably curious girl whose budding STEM skills are celebrated in Andrea Beatty's popular children's book, Ada Twist, Scientist, which was inspired by the groundbreaking achievements of Ada Lovelace and Marie Curie. And now, Anna North's fourth novel features Agnes Lindstrom, a gifted but socially awkward American forensic anthropologist finishing a postdoctoral fellowship at England's Manchester University. Agnes, who specializes in bones and teeth, reads bodies, delving beneath the surface the way some of us read books. When peat cutters discover a remarkably well-preserved female body in a bog in Ludlow, England in 2018, the coroner brings in Agnes to verify its identity and determine the cause of death. Could this be Isabella Navarro, whose husband has confessed to burying her in the moss back in 1961 after she fell backward down stone stairs during a domestic quarrel? Two local scientists, both women, a bioarchaeologist and a pathologist, join Agnes and provide valuable auxiliary data. The X-rays show evidence inconsistent with the husband's account of his wife's fatal plunge. a comparison of the wife's dental records with a chart of the bog body's teeth, the specifics of which I'll leave for readers to discover, confirms Agnes's conclusion that the body is not that of Isabella Navarro. Her pronouncement is upsetting to Isabella's niece, who has been summoned to retrieve what was believed to be her aunt's recently unearthed body and take it back to Spain. Quote, "If it is not my aunt, then who is it?" she asks. This is one of several questions that drive Bog Queen. Bog Queen braids two timelines, one in 2018 involving Agnes, the other in the Iron Age, around 50 BCE, just before the dawn of the Roman era, involving an ambitious young druid. Before Agnes receives the carbon dating report on the body, North's narrative jumps back 2,000 years to the druid's story, in which she recounts efforts to protect and improve the well-being of her clan. Druids served as high-ranking religious leaders and legal and medical authorities in Celtic cultures. Central to these efforts is the perilous journey she takes to visit the king of Camulodunum in the south, near modern-day Colchester. The experienced druid is courted by the king, who seeks to forge a strategic alliance with her people. He wows her with marvels introduced by the Romans, including writing instruments and maps hitherto unknown to the Celts. Meanwhile, Agnes, who is determined to uncover the secrets of the body from the bog and seal her academic future in the process, encounters perils of her own. Never socially adept, even in the best of circumstances, she struggles to negotiate a compromise among groups that are all vying for control over the bog. These include environmentalists, determined to stop all excavations to restore and protect the carbon-rich moss, which is a powerful antidote to climate change. Industrialists and developers eager to sell the peat and build luxury apartments. An archaeologist hoping to gain insights into ancient cultures. And Isabella's niece, who is determined to recover her aunt's body. The result is a strangely beguiling tale that celebrates perseverance, scientific inquiry, environmentalism, progress, and cooperation. North keeps readers turning pages to find out whether Agnes will prevail and solve the mystery of the Bog Woman. Unfortunately, the chapters in which the author attempts to animate the bold young druid's life are less compelling and convincing, often bordering on hokey. In another risky but more successful move, North gives both the first and last word not to her female scientist, but to the book's true hero, the moss. Quote, "A colony of moss does not speak or think in language," she writes, "but if a colony could tell the story of its life, it might say this, 'Once we flourished.'" Later, channeling the moss again, North adds, "Though we may pass through thirsty seasons, some extending across many human lifetimes, eventually we triumph." How? The answer might hold a lesson for humans. Quote, "We create the conditions of our thriving." Next, we come to our In Pictures section in the magazine. This section, In Pictures, the photos are by Melanie Stetson Freeman, a staff photographer. The story is by Stephen Humphreys, a staff writer. The title of the piece is Chugging Along with Nostalgia at the Helm. The dateline is Louisville, Kentucky. And on these pages, we have a lot of photos. We'll get to those in just a minute, but let's read the text first. 22 years ago, Matt Kemp struck up a conversation with crew members of the Belle of Louisville. To him, the sheet-cake-shaped steamboat, built in 1914, evoked nostalgia. "What does it take to get a job here?" Mr. Kemp asked. He got hired as a deck mate. The love affair with steamboats hasn't waned for either Mr. Kemp or the rest of the crew. The vessels are imbued with the romance of a simpler time. Time passed as slowly then as it does now for the Belle of Louisville, slipping past the grand homes lining the Ohio River. Quote, "We're in this little magical bubble that is held in time," Mr. Kemp says. In the lower deck boiler room, which is temperate only in comparison with the surface of Venus, Chief Engineer Daniel Lewis says the engines are the same as they were in Mark Twain's time. Best part of the job? Meeting passengers from around the world. It's hard to hear him talk because the rotating paddle wheel churns the water like a frenzy of piranhas. The roof deck pilot house is more tranquil. Acting Captain Eddie Mattingly describes his job as hours and hours of boredom interrupted by moments of sheer terror. He says he scans the river for small personal watercraft, including jet skis, gnats, who can swarm dangerously close to the vessel. Mr. Mattingly has been doing this for 45 years, so maritime safety is, quite literally, in his wheelhouse. Quote, "As long as you're able to take care of her, she'll keep running," Mr. Lewis says of the boat. So we do have a lot of photos here on these couple of pages, so let's get to those. In our first one, it's titled Full Steam Ahead. The caption reads, "Acting Captain Eddie Mattingly is among the crew members of the Kentucky-based Belle of Louisville, a steamboat that cruises the Ohio River." And let's get a description of that one for you. In this, we see Eddie, the captain. He is wearing a white short-sleeve captain's uniform, and he's wearing a black baseball cap. He's wearing dark sunglasses, and he's wearing black short pants that come down to his knees. Now, he is on the deck, and he has the huge boat's wheel that he is turning, and there is a brass direction here. It's a gauge that reads on it stop, slow, half, full, and it is marking full right now. So maybe that's full steam ahead. We're not sure on that part. So let's get down to our next photograph. The caption here, it reads, "In ship-top shape. The pilot house, where the captain and pilot work, sits on the roof of the Belle of Louisville." Now, what we're seeing here is that little pilot house. It looks like a tiny cottage. It has a blue domed roof, and there's a lattice work around it, white carvings around the top of that. And inside of it, you can see a little stairwell that goes up. And then inside it, you can see Eddie, the captain. He is seated in the captain's chair, and he's looking out over the water. Also, if you step outside of that pilot's house, you see two steamer kind of chimneys there that are where that chugs along. And those are two black spires that are going up into the sky, and those are on either side of the pilot's house. Also on either side of the pilot's house, we see American flags. And the flags are both kind of flapping in the wind, so it looks like a windy day on the water. And the boat is on the water. You can see dark water around it. And then in the far distance, you see land and houses in that distance there. So our next image is titled Paddle Royale. The Belle of Louisville is an icon for the city and a National Historic Landmark. It is the only remaining paddle-wheel-driven steamboat from the American packet boat era. Packet boats carried mail and passengers. And so in this image, the Belle of Louisville is docked. It's at the dock, and you can see it tethered there. And it's an impressive boat. It's a white boat. There's beautiful yellow lettering saying Belle of Louisville on the front of the boat. And there are large sails as well that are available for them. You also see a ramp where people are walking off of the boat and onto the docking area. You see a woman in a green tank top with white slacks, and she's carrying a baby in her arms. And then she has another young child walking beside her, and then a man who appears to be her husband or partner, and he is navigating things. He's looking into his phone as they're walking off the ship. And let's go to our next photograph. This one is titled Turn, Turn, Turn. The boat's paddle wheel is made of 608 paddlewood pieces and weighs 17.5 tons. Each piece can last up to 20 years before needing to be replaced. And it's an overhead view. We're looking down into the paddle wheel. It is churning, and it's painted a bright red, almost a blood red color, like out of a horror story or something. A very kind of a challenging color to look at here. But you can see the spray of the water as this paddle wheel is churning into the water. A very dramatic image. Number 5 photograph. Gentlemen, start the engines. Chief Engineer Daniel Lewis works in the engine room. He says the engines are the same as they were in author Mark Twain's time. Now, what we're seeing here is Daniel Lewis there in the engine room in the photograph. He has a large gauge over him that's telling him if things are getting overheated. He is wearing a black baseball cap, a black short sleeve shirt, and black short pants. And it is a steam room. You can see all of the machinery, the pipes, the different gauges, different equipment here down in this engine or boiler room here. And he has bent over. He has a metal object in his arms that he looks like he's trying to unscrew some device here in that engine room. And that was it for that article. So what we do now is we get to our last page, and let me open up that one for us real quick. And what we've got there is a full page ad, and it is an ad for Smucker's. And at the top of the page, it says fruitful since 1897. A leader in jams and jellies for over 100 years and still growing. Smucker's. The J.M. Smucker's Company, Orville, Ohio. Visit our website at www.smuckers.com. And then in the middle of the page, we see jars of Smucker's jams dating back all the way from 1897 to the present. We have 4 rows and 3 columns of these jams, and you see how dramatically they change from just a paper covering from the 1897 Smucker's jam all the way to the bottom right-hand corner where you see today's jar, and it's a glass jar. It has a red label with strawberries on it that says Smucker's Strawberry Preserves, and then it's a clear glass, and so you can see the strawberries preserves within. All right, let's go to the website to finish up our content for today. Our first article is titled, In Battleground, Michigan, Tariffs Cast a Long Shadow Over the Economy. This article was written by Scott Baldoff, a staff writer, and also its contributor is Riley Robinson, the staff photographer. And the dateline is Three Rivers, Battle Creek, and Orion Township, Michigan. It was published November 7th, 2025 at 5 a.m. In the middle of the page, there is a yellow rectangle that says why we wrote this. The Monitor visited Michigan, a political battleground state, to gauge the economic climate in the first 9 months of the Trump presidency. We found people who are enduring economic uncertainty amid hopes that troubling signs will turn positive. And if we go to the top of the page, there is a photograph. There's a caption. It says, a Tesla drives down North Main Street in Three Rivers, Michigan, October 10th, 2025. After unsafe levels of lead were discovered in the Three Rivers water system because of aging pipes, residents have joined forces across partisan divides to demand solutions from their local government. And what we do see is that Tesla, it's a black Tesla driving toward the camera, and it's driving on a sleepy town, like a main strip of a town where you can see all the storefronts. You see some American flags hanging from the storefronts as well. You can't really make out what those storefronts, what are they selling, but you do see it's a, looks like an old-timey, like 19th century town center. So let's get to the article in our remaining moments here. At the polls on Tuesday, voters signaled concerns about the U.S. economy and about how the Trump administration had steered it in the first 9 months of President Donald Trump's second term. The nation's cautious economic mood, which led to Democratic victories in several states, extends beyond this year's election battlegrounds. Before the election, the Monitor gauged the economic climate by speaking with city officials, chambers of commerce, and business owners in Michigan, a prominent swing state in recent presidential elections. We visited three very different towns, rural Three Rivers, industrial Battle Creek, and booming Orion Township, to ask about the challenges and opportunities that citizens there are facing. The interviews weren't probing for personal political positions. Still, two themes emerged: cautious optimism about the economy and deep concern that the tariffs now in place are dragging on growth. Beyond the tariffs, many local leaders and employers worry that the ongoing government shutdown, now 38 days old, would erase the gains they had made. All felt their own local leaders had a better feel for local sentiment than the leadership in Washington. Each of the cities the Monitor visited has its own story and its own challenges. In Three Rivers, a small, mixed agricultural and manufacturing town reflects the rises and falls of the national economy. In Battle Creek, big changes for a major employer adds uncertainty. And in Orion Township, tariffs cloud the future as a new auto assembly plant comes to town. Three Rivers, navigating a down economy. Surrounded by agricultural lands, Three Rivers has a more complex economy than might appear at first glance. The top employer, for example, is an auto parts plant, American Axle. Much of the nearby farmland was sold off long ago to large agricultural companies, which buy tractors, fertilizers, pesticides, and seeds from larger suppliers rather than local mom-and-pop stores. There are good-paying jobs in Three Rivers, and the city has an industrial blue-collar feel, with its fortunes rising and falling with the overall national economy. Southwest Michigan is pretty stable but super tertiary, says Jamie Clark, president and owner of Clark Logic, a real estate and third-party logistics company based in nearby Portage. With a fleet of 70 trucks and 7 million square feet of warehouse space scattered across Michigan and northern Indiana, Mr. Clark says diversification is the key to his success. We are running out of time, so we'll wrap up the article here. Thank you for joining us for Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.